Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone, how you doing?
I am doing well. It is fun and exciting to get back to work, man. I think it's been too long. It was a long respite for me.
I know, but this is going to be a good show to kick off the year.
This is going to be a fun segment. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with instructor of social entrepreneurship with Georgia State University, a guy by the name of Chris Markle. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the chief executive officer, the grand poobah, the man who makes it happen, over at Serve IT. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Mr. Tony Merendino. How are you, man?
Great. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
All right, Tony, got to lean in there. Got to get karaoke close to that microphone. Is it Serve IT or is it Serve It?
Actually, it's Serve IT.
Serve
Serving
IT.
The IT community is how we came up with the name.
And then what exactly are you doing for folks?
We tend to really focus on value, and we manage IT. You've heard of the cloudy, the hosting types
yes.
of things. That's exactly what we're doing today.
And then what are the types of clients you serve?
You know, we can handle a $5, $10 billion company all the way down to someone who has one or two PCs in their office. So it's very versatile.
And your clients are all over the world?
We have customers that are in the U.S. that have offices around the world. We're basically headquartered in Kennesaw, Georgia. We're registered in 14 states, 20 cities, and we have about 1,300 active clients.
And how'd you get into this business?
Serendipitously. Started as a salesman back years ago and then worked my way up. And then about 28 years old, I started doing this for myself.
So you were always in this industry?
But my first pre-cloud.
What were you doing before the cloud?
Well, Serve IT kind of morphed itself into the managed service cloud in 2008.
Right in time for the economy to crash.
Exactly. Right. Well, the crash actually was our reason for moving to it. We were a channel hardware seller maintenance company for years, and then we transformed to the cloud.
Now, that transformation, that seems like kind of a mental shift you had to make as well.
The most difficult thing I've done in business is transforming a current business model to a new one, without a doubt. Also, the greatest thing we've ever done. So it's the best of both worlds.
Can you talk about how that process began? And you knew you had to make a change, obviously, but to make that type of kind of a systemic change must have been, I mean, you had to have some sleepless nights, I would imagine.
Perfectly used. We use the term systemic all the time. So a lot of self-evaluating, a lot of great people in our lives like Dave Ramsey and Seth Godin. We really look for the smarter people, and we started building new foundations. And the most important thing is we focused on our people and our customers, and then we worked on our secret sauce or our process, and then we worried about our assets later.
So you focused on the why before the how?
Absolutely.
So, but how did that, I mean, you knew the hardware situation wasn't going to be sustainable. You saw the cloud coming. Did you get everybody in a room? Like, can you kind of walk us through how this?
It started with sleepless nights in my brain and then collectively started moving the changeable leadership first. And then we moved the whole leadership. And then slowly but surely, we ate the elephant at a bite at a time.
Did some of your people, though, and some of your customer base at first just think you were being Chicken Little and that you were being a little bit of an alarmist in the early going?
I'm smiling right now. I know you can't see that, but it's exactly what happened. The channel people, the big manufacturers, all thought we were out of our mind, for sure.
And then, so how do you have the confidence in yourself to believe that what your vision of the future is accurate, and then these people are not being accurate?
I don't know if it's bravado, stupidity, headstrong. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's all of the above, but we really believed, if you look over time and space, using the systemic word again, instead of being linear, you had to change in order to survive.
And then the cloud, though, at that time was kind of at the early stages, and it was kind of a, you know, people were throwing it around. It was a buzzword at the time, and people weren't buying in. It wasn't safe. It wasn't secure. It couldn't really work. How'd you get through that?
You know, every year was a little bit better. But it was mostly the Amazons of the world that were playing at that space. There was no small boutique, high value firm out there. And we just started slowly but surely. One customer serendipitously lost a bunch of their programmers and they looked for someone to take over their systems. I think that was 2009 and that was the birthplace. And then we just took it one step at a time.
Now, when you're making that big of a change in the shift and you're trying to keep your people, right? Like you didn't say, okay, I'm going to get rid of everybody or start again, right? How do you kind of change the culture of the company?
Another great question that I'm smiling over. All of the consultants that were helping me said I should start over with new people.
Just start clean.
Start a separate company, and we did not do that. And once again, the transformation of the people who did move to the managed service cloud were spectacular. It's joyous. I'm proud. And the people who didn't was sad because I watched their kids grow up. They couldn't make the transformation for whatever reason. We gave people years to transform, though. Mm-hmm. It just, like I said, was the greatest and saddest time of my life in business.
Now, when you're doing that and you're making that shift again, as the CEO, in your head, you're like, you're deciding. This isn't a simple, oh, let's just flip a switch and now we're going to be cloud-based and forget about the hardware that we've spent the previous 10 years playing around with, right? So now you're going, okay, I'm going to do this. At first, you were probably playing pros and cons, right, of both sides of this. I'm trying to get a little into the minutiae of it because a lot of people are struggling in their own businesses with these type of major decisions, and it's not that simple. It's not that clear cut.
Well, I'm guilty of flying the plane before it's built. As an example of try some things, fail quickly to improve. But the number one thing we did, I think, more than anything else, is we stopped. We diagrammed, we planned, we mind mapped everything we were thinking, so we had a place in time to see where it failed, so we could improve quickly. So we transformed ourselves into from linear to systemic using visuals, saying this is where we are today, this is where we're going. Document, self-assess. So we transformed, said everyone's ideas are important. Create. Failure is a thing, not a person. And we learned to build trust. And then people started actually diving into this. And that was the very beginning of how the movement started.
And when you put up on the board, hardware side and the cloud side, and you're playing it all out, at some point you're like, this is not sustainable, the hardware side. Right, like you had to come to that conclusion, and then you got to get buy-in from everybody else that had spent their whole career in that world.
Well, we were very selective because the hardware didn't turn off like a faucet.
Right.
It was shrinking at a very...
But that's how life works. Right. Like things don't turn off typically as a faucet.
Right. Well, and it can sneak up on you.
Right.
Well, it didn't. And that's why we were crazy, because it didn't sneak up on us. We saw the trend. We started moving different to a service model, and we allowed the people who were successful to do what they wanted to do. If they wanted to come to this side and learn, great. If you didn't and you can make a living doing this, great. But we were moving, serving both communities,
right,
and watching the people come over as it made sense for them. As their W-2s shrunk or their worthwhile work disappeared, we watched the transformation happen slowly. But we actually served two people at that time, the hardware side as well as the new business.
Now, were you able to, were any of your clients kind of forward thinking that were saying, you know what, we believe in you, you're a sharp guy, you've never kind of hurt us in the past, you've always helped us and watched our back, we'll kind of take the leap with you.
Right. That did happen, obviously. Well, we've been doing this for, I guess I've been in business for 30 plus years now, and there's still some of the same clients, and something usually happens. Someone retires. Hey, instead of me buying the hardware and Billy is leaving, maybe I should look at hosting or cloud. Mm-hmm. And that's how it all begins. It starts with, maybe I should look at it differently.
So some forward-thinking clients really helped make this decision a lot easier.
It's always about the people. Without a doubt, the clients drove it. They were looking, they were listening, they were transforming, but it was slowly.
Early in the conversation, you mentioned Dave Ramsey. Now, I'm identifying that name with someone who helps people with their personal finances. Are we talking about the same guy? But he's also really kind of coming to his own on the leadership development front. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, the Entree Leadership series on podcast, and then how he manages money. We moved, and I'll give you an example of that, what we're talking about, how Dave was very important to us. 2008 and 2009. is when the world decided to shift and make a little dip in the economy. We were always profitable, and we always had a line of credit just in case for payroll. So our banking got bought out. New banker showed up, said, "We have great news for you. Your line of credit of $500,000 is now $200,000. And we said, well, why? They said, "Well, you never use it." I said, "That's the reason." And we talked about, "Well, we don't think you need it." "Oh, so you're now going to..."
Now they're on your team.
"You're now they're on my team. Now they're going to help me, right?" So we actually put a line in this and said, "We're never going to be in a position to have someone decide what we're going to do or not." So at that moment, we did something called the 1%. Every dollar that showed up on our doorstep, we moved to a separate account until we got a significant amount of money, 6 months of payroll. We're completely debt-free, all based on the principles of Dave, Entree Leadership, both aspects, the financial side and the leadership side. So that's an example of deploying.
So you gave yourself your own line of credit.
Yeah, exactly right. And since that time, we've now delivered this against all of our principles. Stay free, move forward, and be unencumbered so we can create the life we want to live.
Now, how do you disseminate this kind of passion and this kind of culture throughout the entire company?
You live it every day. You wake up and you realize that the only thing we have is something bigger than ourselves. And we focus on the 100 folks plus their kids and their wives and the spouses. And we realize there's a 300 some odd people out there that we're responsible for. So we dedicate ourselves to something bigger than ourselves. And we focus on what we can do to improve their lives, improve our customers' lives through value, through principle, through self-assessing and continual improvement.
Now, but how does that play out in the organization? Do you have people on the team that are like in charge of culture, that are in charge of paying attention, that if somebody's kid got hurt and the company can help, like, do you have things like that?
I don't know if it's that specific. So for an example, every morning since 2009, we've had a meeting called CIB, Continual Improvement Board. Continual improvement is out of the ITIL, which is a standard in the world that I live in. It's a self-imposed like Six Sigma or HIPAA, things like that. So we meet every day to see everything's aligned, all our checks and balances, anything going on, is a customer hurting, is there a family hurting? The CIB handles every single possible thing every morning from 8 to 8:30 for the last 7 years.
So now people report in from all over?
You have to be invited. You have to be passionate. You have to believe in something bigger than yourself. So it's an invitation and it's growing. Mm-hmm. So there are wonderful people at work, but there are some people that are a little bit more passionate, a little bit more interested in growing the company through this type of methodology.
And then it seems like that's kind of a recurring theme, that you find these passionate people and they become kind of the evangelists.
Yeah, we interview a little different these days. I think it takes about 30 resumes to get one. And then wow, there's probably 5 to 6 interview processes with multiple people to get the top three. So it's we want someone highly motivated, a great attitude, and wants to show up to do something, some work that's a little bigger than themselves, besides a paycheck.
Now, all those things you never mentioned, the skill of the task. That's not as
that's
important.
Table stakes.
That's
here's how I like to say that, because that's a very good question. Cognitive intelligence is on the resume. We're looking for high emotional intellect. Mm-hmm. We hate drama. Most everybody has 3 digits in their IQ. They wouldn't be interviewing if they didn't. We'd rather have great attitude and high emotional intellect than cognitive skills. Now, don't get me wrong. We have to have some rocket scientists. They've got to be able to rock and roll on certain problems, but they get interviewed the same way and they have both. But it's most important to have high emotional intellect.
So if somebody's interviewing for candidates that are that they also want that high intellectual or high emotional quotient, I guess you're looking at.
Sure.
What are some tips and tricks to help them?
What
are red flags and what are things that if they did that, they're almost there?
Make it a focal point. Have a plan. What will you tolerate? What will you not? So build yourself a SWOT analysis of some sort on what you're going to want in the organization based on either job set or salary or whatever makes sense. And then think about maybe spending some money on tests, like whether it's free, like a DISC test, or the opposite end of the spectrum is a Harrison assessment. Depending on the salary, we determine which test is most fit for the individual. Let multiple people interview. Make sure everybody understands what's going on, document everything, and just build a process associated with what the end result is going to look like.
So during the process, you want them to exhibit the behavior you're looking for?
It would be helpful. It's difficult and when someone's interviewing. So we try and, like you guys did to me, drop my shoulders a little bit, relax. It's going to be okay. Talk to me a little bit. So the questions are basically focused around, you know, long-term systemic thinking versus linear.
So do you ever run into this? This is a personal challenge of mine. I think I have a tendency to almost hire in my own image. Do you ever run into that personally, or do you have people that have that challenge?
It's very difficult because we are, without getting too technical, have reptilian brains. We're very selfish in nature, self-preservation, fight or flight. I get all that. So you have to talk about that prior and make sure that we interview based on what we want and what is needed versus self-reflection. That's a really good question, by the way. Difficult, but good question.
Now, in the managed IT space and in the IT space in general, do you find that most people are, most of your competitors are attacking their business in your manner, or are they looking at it more in a transactional manner? Yours seems very relationship driven.
Without knowing their businesses, it appears very transactional, very old school. One of the things we do is we have to, Simon Sinek has a TED talk about the why. It exposes that it exists. We actually deliver against the roadmap on how to discover the why. So if you're going to sell for us, if you're going to be a project manager, you have to dig through a discovery analysis that we've customized and is patent pending, believe it or not, on how to do that. So we feel like you're going to either get pushed away because we're unaligned, because you're looking for a transaction and we're looking for a relationship long-term. We tell everybody we're interviewing for a babysitting job. This is, we're not selling. This is personal.
So now some of the clients are, some clients are like, or maybe not clients for you, but some people who have the need for your service want a transactional relationship. They just don't, you know, that's what they're used to. That's what they've always had. Those aren't good prospects for you, right?
We gently walk away from the opportunity, not the person or the business, through our process. Mm-hmm. So we can have a law firm with two desktops, and Southwire here in town is a customer. They have 9,000 PCs in 6 or 7 different countries. So we truly have to be aligned, whether it's through greater good, through experiences of a business analysis, not just dollars and cents.
Now, how did you mentioned the companies in Kennesaw? Why did you choose Kennesaw?
That's where my wife's family's from. Very, very strategic.
So it's relationship driven.
Exactly. There you go.
Just like the man said. But your salespeople, it sounds to me like a big part of their job would be to educate.
Yeah, I think educating on features and benefit is a traditional selling job, especially in technology. It's so hard not to do that.
Right.
That has its moment, but more importantly, nobody woke up today and said, gee, I need more IBM. They usually say something like that. And then we say a computer. Well, you didn't really want a computer. You maybe need more horsepower. Why is that? Well, we're looking at an acquisition. So as I can actually walk you through about a dozen of those and get to the real reason. Mm-hmm. It could be for, I want all my line managers to have instant information. It has nothing to do with IBM, but we buy and sell IBM. That's where the selling starts and story begins by saying, that's not really what you wanted. So that's kind of how we do it a little different.
So it's storytelling versus selling?
Absolutely.
And a heck of a lot of listening, it sounds like.
Well, if you don't want to listen to us, you're probably not aligned. You're looking for a transaction.
Right. So maybe a lot of the education is in the other direction. Maybe you set the stage for the customer, the client, to educate you on what's going to meet their needs and solve their problems.
The real why is exactly right. We become psychiatrists and listeners, and we have to point them in a direction of what they really, really want. You're dead on with that.
Now, part of, I would imagine, the benefit of working with your company is that because technology is changing so rapidly, it's impossible for me. I got a job to do. I'm working in my business. I can't keep track of all this stuff. That becomes your headache, right?
Correct. When people, customers and people said, I no longer want to own, I want you to manage it. They want it outsourced, meaning the means of production. I believe what you do, Tony, is important, they say. I just don't want to be involved, nor do I want it to go down. So what happens is...
Don't screw it up.
So our next guest, Chris, is on the digital side of things. We own a marketing company called Reimage. What happens is they start moving up the food chain, and they start with their desktops and their servers, and then their email, the collaborative, and then...
And their phones, right?
And their voice over IP phones, which are now digital. So as they move up, they give you more and more as they want to focus on their business with their application. That's where we stop. All the middleware stack, which is collaboration, email, so on and so forth, all the way down to the desktop. And they give you more and more as they start moving themselves to a business-focused IT agenda versus hardware maintenance, upgrades. That's no longer worthwhile work, in our opinion.
Now, from the customer side, the reason to switch from this, owning versus managing?
Correct.
It's financially better, and I don't have to deal with the headaches? Like, what are the pain points that I'm removing by switching?
Now, that's probably one of the best questions asked, especially early on from our customers, because they don't understand the ROI, the return on investment. It's almost a dead even hardware and people if you get managed. So it's a recurring revenue versus managing the person, paying for the person, all of the expenses, the education, the laptop, and then it's all of the other things.
It's the updating, upkeep, right?
They have a known budget with us, and they don't have to deal with the people being sick, on vacation, education. So it's the soft dollars that really make it affordable. Sometimes hard to see in the initial conversation, but the minute they get a taste of it, it's pretty much full speed ahead.
Now, can you share a story, maybe a small company that benefited from working with you guys, where what they were doing previously and working with you that was able to help them in their business?
Mostly it's soft. One of the most specific ones is an $80 million company that makes motherboards for AT&T. They're about 15 or 20 years old. They moved most of their stuff to the cloud. They were worried at first, and they gave us more and more. And all of a sudden, one afternoon, about 3 o'clock, they said, we have a virus on our SQL server, and we can't get to it. And we have this big order with AT&T. We actually stood up a copy, since we had their backup, of their SQL server in our data center. Within 35 minutes, they were back in production, did not miss a lick. They said if they were back to their old school with tapes or on-site, this would have never happened. It would have been days.
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 And it was a half an hour.
It was 35 minutes before they got on board. And we have, you know, little stories like that,
right,
bigger stories like that. But that's why if you're managed and you have replication, life's a little easier.
So what's next for you? You got anything exciting that you're allowed to talk about where you're going to focus your energy over the next 12, 18 months?
Personally or with the Serve IT?
Absolutely.
All the above.
We publish it all, man. Okay. But I was actually thinking from the business standpoint.
So, you know, Serve IT seems to be, it's 500% growth. We're debt-free. We seem to be at the right place at the right time due to my insanity about 8 years ago. So that's moving slowly. I have a gentleman who's been with me since he's 18. He's 45. He's running day-to-day. We actually think Reimage is going to explode. People are wanting more e-commerce sites. They're wanting to attack the Google machine through SEO and PPC. So that's gearing itself up now. Personally, I also bought an organic cattle ranch, which I spent some time on, which is now a real business. The world seems to be changing their diet, and I seem to be in vogue right now, or my farm does anyway. So those are some of the things we're focusing on, Reimage, and then continue improving and make Serve IT.
What does Reimage mean?
It's just the name of the marketing company that we own that builds websites, e-commerce sites, and does PPC and SEO, digital marketing.
And then that, they do that for what size company?
We tend to only want to do that for our current customers with Serve IT because content seems to be lacking and spends a lot of time. So if you're currently paying us to be serving one aspect of your business, we don't mind spending the time with your content. Brand new customers is somewhat difficult. So currently it's only for active Serve IT customers that want to move to that.
But don't they have their own?
Everybody
right
has they always has they, something, but there always seems to be in transformation. You know, they want more stuff. And the foundation of their old website. So now mobile,
right,
access is hot. Google changed the parameters. You have to be mobile ready. You have to be constantly changing your content, and you have to be hardwired in order for them to be ranking you up at the top. So some of these sites aren't ready.
Now, that seems like a sea change shift. Like one is cloud-based and one is marketing. How do they overlap?
Well, they overlap because it's technology and our customers are requesting it. So once again, I don't think Reimage does $1 million a year in business. We think that'll double because our customers trust us with their baby, as I mentioned earlier. Right. So why not ask us for the other stuff? So we're getting better, and it's about 3-year-old company. So it's pretty solid in its understanding of what customers need.
And you had staff on hand that did that?
Yes. Originally, and then we moved their payroll over. Correct. That's how it started. It was birthed internally and was moved out. Yeah.
And that's a good lesson for everybody in that you give your customers what they want, right?
As long as it's not too far out of the box, yes.
Right.
Well, you pay attention and find out what they want, and you could even go so far as to ask them.
Right? Shockingly, yes.
I love it.
So now, if you were to give advice for a CEO of a company that's out there and they're going to make this kind of sea change shift in culture and in the kind of the focus of the business, what would you say to them to help them kind of get their head right and really move to this? This seems like to be almost like a higher level of doing business where you're not only do you care about, making money and things like that, but you're also really serving all of your internal people. You're really truly serving your clients. And you're really and truly serving your community.
Yeah, we're kind of wired like that. And thanks for noticing that. That's exactly who we are. So what advice, whatever it's worth, I would give is self-reflection. What do you really want? If you're looking for a jet versus serving, your employees and your customers, maybe it's time to take a shift and look at what you really want. So have the heart of a servant. Then build a plan on what you're going to deliver. Build roadmap so your employees can actually see the effect that they have on the work. And that's what we call worthwhile work. They visualize what the person behind them does and what the person in front of them does. And so they actually feel more connected. You build trust where someone has an idea, you celebrate it, you don't belittle them. And then, once you have this vision of what you want to do and then just grind it out and get smart people around you, it really helps.
And if somebody wants to learn more, maybe join your team or be a client, where should they go?
Yeah, the world famous www.serveit.net is available. You gentlemen have my personal information. If anybody calls you guys up, please feel free to share that with anybody. I do some public speaking, which I don't get paid for, but...
And what topics do you speak on?
I speak on outcome-based selling, which is the why. And we actually deliver that. And it's usually a Kiwanis or, CPA, continual improvement. I actually do something for Plexus, the local chapter of about 80 women. I've done some stuff there. So those are the things that I want to pay forward by sharing this why roadmap on how it can improve your life. And then when I tell everybody, it's not just for your job for 8 hours. You become a better spouse when you get home because you can't be a servant at work and be a knucklehead at home.
It's hard to turn that on and off, right?
Then you really got to really look deep into your soul.
Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Keep up the good work, man. I am so glad that we had a chance to visit this morning. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure, and I wish you guys nothing but the best for 2017.
Can you hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely.
All right, gang. Y'all ready for the headliner?
All right.
He's been sitting there very patiently. I saw he's wrong-handed. I noticed that. I pick up these little clues. But in his best left hand, I saw him taking copious notes during our visit with you, Tony, but I bet he has a little wisdom to drop on us of his own. Please join me in welcoming to the show, visiting instructor of social entrepreneurship with Georgia State University, Mr. Chris Markle. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So, Chris, you're with Georgia State University, right?
Yeah, I started in the fall as a faculty member there to lead their new social entrepreneurship program.
And can you first, before we get too far into it, let's define some terms. What exactly is social entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I get that question all the time. And many times people think it's social media, but it is not.
Really? That's
so
interesting.
Social entrepreneurship is really just entrepreneurship and innovation to solve any social problem. That could be anything from poverty to cancer to gender equality. Any of the issues that we care about, what we see is that wouldn't say that we've reached the, we're approaching the limits of government's ability to solve these problems.
You think so?
And sometimes smart people who have personal knowledge with these problems or have thought about them can solve them in much more efficient ways. And we see amazing nonprofits and for-profits augment the efforts of governments and sometimes replace it in a more efficient way to improve outcomes for society.
So now, typically in business, things are driven for profits or for shareholders. This seems like you're trying to take it in a slightly different direction where you're adding different stakeholders.
Potentially. I mean, having a social mission or improving the world can be a profit maximizing strategy. So I want to step away from saying it's mutually exclusive.
Right.
And in fact, what research shows is that I think 90-some percent of people will switch to a company if they're associated with a with some sort of social good or social aim. So I think many corporations that we might, or many organizations, even ones that we don't think as being social enterprises or trying to improve the world, I think they're trying to think about how their products can have a social lens to them. So I think more of this spectrum from everything from a traditional nonprofit to a traditional for-profit, all these organizations can benefit from, embracing the idea of social innovation generally.
Are there any companies out there now that are kind of examples of this kind of leadership?
Yes. Well, I mean, so I work more on the, currently I work more on the startup side, early stage, usually technology-based organizations, but relocating to Atlanta, I would like to embrace corporate social innovation and the organizations that are working here, just because this is such a major hub for
so many large companies.
Yeah, and I mean, think everything from Home Depot, Chick-fil-A, all of them have corporate social innovation programs. One of my goals here at Georgia State is to build bridges between these major companies and Georgia State. Maybe we can help these for-profit companies, one, improve their impact, maybe two, add value to Georgia State students, and maybe, you know, they can actually become more profitable through highlighting the amazing work they're doing. I mean, if we asked what Home Depot is doing to improve the world, I mean, maybe none of us don't know right now, but they're probably giving away millions of dollars. And there's probably some improvement that can happen there for the consumers that shop there.
And then, but this is actually going to be a degree at Georgia
State?
Yeah.
So, yes, it's an interdisciplinary degree between, I'm housed in the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies, which is a highly ranked policy studies school. I'm in the nonprofit management program, which is number 10 in the country for graduate programs in nonprofit management. And it's an interdisciplinary degree between the Andrew Young School and the Robinson College of Business at
Georgia
State. So it's
kind of the bridge between policy and the business?
Yeah. So, I mean, you could think about Andrew Young as one of the original social entrepreneurs here in the city of Atlanta. Obviously, worked through some difficult times here to make Atlanta a forward-thinking city and do amazing things like bring the Olympics here. And so it's a natural fit. The Andrew Young School has been thinking about social problems.
Right.
And so you could think before, like we have one of the top MPA programs in the country as well. You could think that instead of just working for the government to improve the world, now all these the industry is evolving, that you can work in the private sector to improve the world. And so you take the same policy training, trying to understand what's going on in social problems. This is very similar to our early guest, right? Like the guest before. The idea is, what does the customer want, right?
Right.
If you're trying to solve a problem, what does that beneficiary want? Like, what is their life really like? I mean, it's, as we know, it's incredibly difficult to solve any problem, you know, whether it's education, homelessness, you know, increasing economic mobility. I mean, if these problems were simple, we would have solved them. But they're incredibly difficult to just understand what's going on.
Well, the difficulty also lies in the complexity of it. There's so many different constituents in any given problem. And it's hard for one person to have the vision to see how all of those kind of lines are out there without tangling them all.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I like social innovation or social entrepreneurship in general, because you can kind of remove unnecessary stakeholders and sidestep these traditional, barriers to social change. And so you see some small organizations getting huge momentum, just like a traditional tech for-profit startup, because right. they've like got onto something. So a couple examples. One local that was founded here is a nonprofit called New Story. I don't know if you guys heard of them, but they crowdfund to build homes in Haiti. It started from, I was at FSU before as a faculty administrator, started by an alum at FSU, Brett Hagler, and for $6,000, they'll build a home for a family, and they'll send you a picture and a video of the family in the home. And So there was like an NFL player for the Ravens. Every time he got a sack, he would like build a home.
And that's
like,
great.
They started getting all these corporate sponsorships, and like they went through one the top technology accelerator, Y Combinator, and they're building an amazing platform that really connects donors with this experience And being transparent about the impact they're creating. Another for-profit technology-based social enterprise that's purely for-profit is Remitly. So I worked in Africa before I ran a business in Kenya. And it was really hard to send money internationally. It's just long delays, giant pain. You go to Western Union, there's tons of fees. Remitly is just an app and they remove all the fees. You know, and that what's the big deal? Well, remittances, which is money that's sent from people who are from a diaspora, basically sent back home, is like three times greater. It's two or three times greater than foreign aid, right? So if you reduce the time, the cost, the barriers, so if you move to America from, let's say, Kenya, and you make it easy for you to send money back home, like that's a significant improvement for the lives of people that are receiving those funds.
Right.
And so Remitly, it's basically free if it's 24 hours or there's a couple dollar fee if you want it instant. So it's a for-profit business having a massive impact just by reducing all these barriers that existed in sending money. And so that's ultimately kind of where I see social enterprise going. Government services might ultimately be reduced in many areas, and you see private sector, solutions that are more innovative take over because they're improving lives in a lower cost fashion.
All right, so this Remitly idea, This was generated from a person or a group of people who were acutely aware of this challenge with the money. My question is, are there ways for people like me who I'm not acutely aware of these challenges, but if I knew about it, I might start my brain or my resources to work on it? Is there somewhere to go find out what these...
Yeah, I mean, as we know, there's unlimited amount of social problems that exist, right? Like, so I think of every social problem as either elongating lives or reducing suffering or improving lives of human and animals, or we can talk about the environment, but ultimately the environment's to improve the lives of people and animals, right? Like, I mean, I think so. I try not to force people to think about one issue or another, because just like business, right? You don't know what to build. You don't know what your customers want. Right. And the only way to find out is to be really kind of obsessive about it. We all are attracted to different causes for different reasons. Maybe a family member was affected by something, maybe something in our neighborhood or a town we're from, we've seen a change. And so just think about things that you're interested in your own life. And there are two ways you can contribute. You can either find an organization that's working in that field and try to add some of your business expertise, right? And the right organization might be interested in that. Or two, if you're really passionate about something, you could just think about the problem, try to figure out what organizations are doing, what innovative solution you might want to attempt to further improve the impact there, and then just act like a business, like ask beneficiaries if they like that solution, right? Just go out and test it. What you said earlier, like asking customers what they want, I mean, that's all we do in social entrepreneurship. That's all I force my students to do, like not just sit in the classroom, but get out there and like ask people if this is a good idea, if they would use it, if it would be beneficial, what do they want, right? At the end of the day, like, I mean, I've worked in, I guess, the science side of entrepreneurship for a few years. What I've realized is the products don't matter, right? Like, it doesn't matter what you build. It just matters if people are using it, right? And they find it beneficial. And that it's just as difficult in the social aspect, the social entrepreneurship realm, as traditional entrepreneurship. So, you know, what goes on in our brains isn't what matters, right? It's right. What if customers use it.
Well, part of what I'm hearing here is innovative doesn't necessarily mean I got to go back to the shop and build this brand new mousetrap that nobody's ever heard of or seen. It may be that resources I'm applying right now over here in one area, If I were to rechannel them over here for this need and this cause, it might just really rock their world.
Right, it might be a win-win for everybody.
Doesn't have to be a brand new thing, right?
I mean, there's tons of simple solutions that have significant improvements. So another example is an app that just sends text message reminders when you should take your medicine. And that saves lives just by people will look
I'll
at
bet
their.
It does.
Yeah. I mean, so the idea is these don't have to be complex things, right? It's that there can be simple innovations that save, like that will save thousands and thousands of lives and reduce suffering, like hospital revisits, right? Like one of the biggest issues with after people leave, basically, if you follow all your doctor's instructions, you're going to maximize their likelihood of health. But like, we're really terrible at that. Everyone is. We're all busy, you know. And so, you know, just simple reminders will save lives. So it's not about having the most, you know, I guess, elegant or complex solution. I think what's really interesting is these simple things that are really obvious. You know, I mean, it's like that in business, right? Like the simpler the business,
right,
the more likely it is to scale. You're probably onto something if you simplified it. And so, you know, I take social entrepreneurship just like traditional entrepreneurship in business, right? What matters is how many people are you helping, right? How many people are actually using your product? What value are they getting from it? Are they talking to other people about it, right? Are you seeing increased in growth around this nonprofit or this for-profit, whatever it is, right? So, you know, whether it's a for-profit or nonprofit doesn't matter to me as much. You know, the funding mechanism, if you're getting donations or you're getting money from your, I guess, beneficiaries, like, you know, that's just a different business, a different revenue model, right? You're just trying to maximize impact and grow your organization like you would in a for-profit operation, which, you know, in social enterprise and social entrepreneurship, you can have a strictly for-profit and make a ton of money. What's wrong with making a ton of money while you're helping people, right? Why can we only make a ton of money when we're potentially not, well, people think we're not helping, but I always think we're helping people. But, you know, like that's what I think social entrepreneurship's about is mirroring potentially financial security with the ability to, quote unquote, improve the world.
Now, why should a student who's in college there at Georgia State consider doing this? Like, who is your target student for this?
Yeah, so I don't want to force students to you know, I want students to find out what they're passionate about. You know, that's what I've discovered.
But do you think that your prospective social entrepreneurship student is coming from the policy side, or do you think they're coming from the business side?
I mean, both. So education today is not like when we went to school. So even I graduated undergrad in 2002. You went to class, you know, I did well in school, and then I had a part-time job, and then I went to sleep, and I just repeated, right? Like, now it's the case that if you just have good grades, that's not enough to excel either to get into a top graduate school or to get an amazing job. What employers and graduate schools are looking for are experiences. Specifically, when a student graduates, they should have a portfolio of high-impact co-curricular experiences, co-curricular meaning everything outside the classroom, that they can show an employer expertise about an issue or an area, right? And then also, you know, experience that they've actually done something, thought about it, maybe built something, sold something, marketed something.
Right, but isn't entrepreneurship by definition is that you're preparing them to do their own thing?
Potentially. I mean, so I think there's a kind of misnomer in university entrepreneurship that students, when they graduate, they'll become entrepreneurs instantly. I mean, in technology entrepreneurship, it's recommended that you go work for the best technology firm you can find for a couple of years. Maybe if you can end up at a Google and then do that for a few years and then, you know, go figure out what you want
right.
to launch.
Well, what I'm saying, I'm not saying immediately become an entrepreneur, but at least have your mind open that I'm no longer on a path of I have to get a job. I have to work for someone else. At some point that I am going to do, you know, I'm going to choose myself and do my own thing.
Yeah. I mean, so I think there's a ton of misunderstanding around entrepreneurship, right? People think they're going to work for themselves. They're going to be playing golf. Like, you're laughing, Emma.
Well, I don't.
Exactly.
I'm not saying you specific, but like, you know, what we see is that every organization wants to become innovative. Every organization that's going to survive wants to become innovative today. And so what I see employers, what they're looking for is you can communicate, you have emotional intelligence, our guest described before, you have domain expertise, but then you understand the innovation and entrepreneurship process. I actually think that gaining entrepreneurship training while you're in school is probably some of the best I guess, insurance you can have for your career, not just in the sense that you can launch your own venture, but the idea that that skill, I think, is going to be highly attractive to employers over the next 5, 10, 20 years, because they just don't want you to just punch numbers in, because that's all going to be automated, right? Like, think about the next 5, 10, 20 years, so many jobs are going to be automated. The one thing that I think is the hardest to automate is that innovation process, right? And so with our training, even in my class, I teach in a big lecture hall, you know, my students go through the innovation process. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to take their projects and become entrepreneurs and launch nonprofits or for-profits from them. But if they ever are interested in a problem, they should know from there what they can do about it to kind of test that idea or test that problem to understand it and see if it has legs to move forward.
Well, okay, give me an example of how a person who isn't kind of understand the philosophy of entrepreneurship would handle a problem versus the person who thinks that, well, I'm just, you know, I have a job, I work for someone, I do whatever they tell me.
So, okay, I can tell you what students who come to me who want to be entrepreneurs, what they do versus what I recommend, you know, after someone becomes has experience in this innovative process. So students come to me and they say, I've got an idea. It's the best idea in the world. No one's ever thought of this idea, right? Right. Oh my God, let's do this. Where do I get my $1 million, right? And what's really interesting is, like, one, all these ideas are somewhat terrible. And even the good ones, like, we don't know if they're good or not. So if you actually talk to technology investors, they say, we don't know what ideas are really good or what or aren't. The only, and this is what gets back to my point earlier, we don't know, the product doesn't matter that much, right? Like, Facebook is worth what, like $280 billion, something around there right now. It's not worth that because of its product. Why is it worth $280 billion or whatever it is?
Because there's a billion people on it.
Yeah, because of revenue and usage, right? And so what people traditionally do is they'll take 6 months in a year, right? They'll try and convince their friends to give them money, tell them they're an entrepreneur. They'll tell everyone they're an entrepreneur, like, try and build something. And then after a year, after they're bowed out of their own money and money they've gathered from their friends, they'll try to put it out there and no one will care, right? And the product they've built probably isn't that good. What you'll do if you're in the innovation process, right? I mean, if you've gone through this innovation process enough, one, it's not about your idea, right? Before you get to your idea, you have to understand the problem. You have to understand the problem and you have to understand other attempts to solve that problem. That's where I tell students to focus on. So, you know, if you focus on the problem, even if you have an idea, then it might not be the best idea, right? Once you have domain expertise about the problem and what else is out there, then you can develop a list of potential ways to attack that problem. And what I tell students or entrepreneurs in general is find the way to reduce the cost in time and effort to test this idea as quickly as possible. And so there's an example of a tech company, I think DoorDash. They went through Y Combinator, and the guys actually, this was before delivery was hot. They were students at Stanford. They had an idea for a food delivery, like restaurant delivery. They just put up a website, or actually they went to restaurants, got menus, scanned them in, and put up PDF menus on a website within an hour, right? And then they got a call that day, and they said, what do we do? Well, we go pick up the food and deliver it, right? And that's what they started to do.
So they got real data. It wasn't kind of theoretical, a bunch of people in the dorm room kind of brainstorming.
Yeah, the idea is, like, you know, you fall in love with your idea, but that's just the complete wrong way to go about business, entrepreneurship, or anything, right? You don't matter when you're trying to build an organization. What matters is your customers, the people you're trying to help. And so, you know, Y Combinator says build products people love, right? You have to build something that a customer or beneficiary loves and then just replicate that over and over again, right? The startup mode is about finding the product that people are so in love with, they'll talk to their friends about it. Like, when Airbnb launched, that's when I was working in Kenya, and I was out of the country about 100 and some days a year. I would tell all my friends about Airbnb because I was staying in cool places, Amsterdam, Sweden, Paris, you know, like, it was an amazing experience. And so it's really, 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 really hard to build something that people love. It's really hard to get on to an idea that actually has legs. And it's really easy to fall in love with an idea that has a little bit of traction that people kind of like, but is kind of terrible and just stalling your time for years and years and years. And so what I try and tell entrepreneurs I work with is think really about the problem and keep talking to the people you're trying to help continuously. And you have to be growing. It's all about user growth. If you're not growing, you should potentially stop working on your organization. You should quit a lot on crappy ideas or crappy like problems, right? Because working on that can actually be preventing you from finding something much bigger. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what we do at Georgia State is we provide a safe space. These students aren't, you know, on their own having to pay their bills, right? Like they're taking classes, they're meeting their goals, moving forward, but they can also think about launching a nonprofit or a for-profit. An example with a student at FSU, when I was at FSU, I worked with Raymond. His grandfather was homeless, and he wanted to do something to help individuals who experience homelessness. And so he went down the homeless shelter, and he just started talking to the people at work there, the residents at the homeless shelter. And he found out that a decent percentage of individuals who experience homelessness actually have some small form of stable income. It could be disability from the government, which is only like $700 a month, or some a pension, something like that. So they had enough to pay rent, but they didn't have enough for the deposits, meaning first and last month's rent, utilities deposits if you're in a low-income area, et cetera. And so he started a website to just crowdfund for that deposit. Like he's a senior at FSU now. By now, he's gotten 100 people off the streets in Tallahassee. Everyone in the city of Tallahassee who has stable income yet is homeless will be housed because of this nonprofit he started. And so think about it. He graduates this spring. He's launched this organization, right? He's won competition success. He marketed this nonprofit. I mean, who wouldn't hire him, right? Like he's executed a ton of things. So it doesn't matter. One, if you wanted to stay working in an organization helping homelessness, he could. If he wanted to expand this, he could. Or he could work in any field he wants. Like he's demonstrated his ability to execute things, which I think is more than many students can do when they graduate. So that's what I think entrepreneurship is. It's or at least at the university level. It's not about taking undergrads and saying, hey, day one, when you graduate, you're going to be launching your venture, which could happen. But more likely, you're getting real experience in the entrepreneurship and innovation process.
And it's kind of changing your mindset a little bit.
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing is when I sit in classes, students think they can just do anything. They're just like going to build. It's so easy. But then you get out there and try to sell something to someone that you try to build something and then sell it to someone that you don't know.
That's a little different animal there.
I mean, there's such learning that happens in that first meeting, exactly. And so, when I was a graduate student at the University of Colorado, I was studying international development. And that's when I got my first taste of entrepreneurship. I was a cyclist and a marathon runner, and I decided to create a cross-country bicycle ride. This was before social entrepreneurship was called social entrepreneurship. And, it was a charity ride. People had to raise like $4,000 or $5,000 to participate, and people got to ride across America and like stay in churches and schools. And, we raised close to $100,000, and, we were on the Today Show, interviewed by Al Roker, and, 85% of the money went to the beneficiary organizations that include the Emory Vaccine Center here in Atlanta. And God, that experience, I was a student, even though I was a graduate student, changed my life. Like, it's just like, It was just really powerful to build something, and like empower other people to create change. And so that experience led me to kind of fall in love with entrepreneurship. But then through my experiences as well in Kenya, I think there's just a misunderstanding of what entrepreneurship is like today. It's not the glamorous thing. I mean, all entrepreneurs know this, right? It's not the glamorous life that people portray on TV and such, but it's exciting to create, and it's exciting to connect with people and to help them. And I will say that I'm an economist, and I think that all business is social. This radio show is a social enterprise, right? You guys are providing knowledge to people that they wouldn't have otherwise. And your organization as well, Serve IT, right? Like, you're helping businesses focus on their core competencies, right?
It's exactly the same as yours, except the product is different. Like, yeah, you mentioned. Exactly. That's it. Nothing else.
Yeah, yeah. So for me, that's what I see Social entrepreneurship, traditional entrepreneurship, it's pretty much the same thing. And for students, the earlier you can get involved, you just get further along in that learning. I think entrepreneurship and innovation training is, I mean, for anyone actually, is probably the best way to guarantee, or I guess secure a career forward.
Right, and really serve the communities you live in and the country as a whole. I mean, the more entrepreneurial thinking people out there, I think the better the country will be.
And absolutely. You're absolutely right. That is the person I want to hire, a person with that level of initiative, that level of personal accountability. I would think this group of people, they probably take and expect more personal responsibility. I mean, all of those characteristics, I bet, are just ever present in this group compared to the general population, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, if you find the right student entrepreneurs, right? I mean, so I found the best student entrepreneurs, or just entrepreneurs in general, are passionate about something, right? They're passionate about that one problem. They understand the problem. I think the entrepreneurs who aren't so successful are the ones that just think they're going to make a ton of money. They're just looking for that right idea. You know, it's not about the idea. Like, every idea is kind of terrible when it starts, right? The way an idea gets better is through conversations, right? Conversations here among smart other people, or more importantly, conversations with your customer. And so, you know, I found that entrepreneurs that try to game the system, you know, like, oh, this is the idea, they're not committed enough to have those conversations, to go down to the homeless shelter or go down to even their cut. Like, I know people who have built technical products, they're entrepreneurs, but won't go out and sell it, right? And like, because they're not in love with the problem. And so, you know, that's what I think. Find your passion, find out what you love. And that's, for me, been the key to kind of be somewhat good at something. Otherwise, I'm not interested enough to obsess about it 24 right. hours
I
a
think
day, 7 days
Tony
a week.
Mentioned the Simon Sinek video, if anybody is interested in that, talks about the why and less about the what or the how.
Yeah.
You got to get the why right.
Yeah, I mean, but we could think about this in businesses that are failing today. JCPenney, right? Like, I mean, it doesn't matter. Blockbuster. Like, if they were obsessed with the problem their customers were facing, you know, they would be the top retailer, or Blockbuster would just be Netflix. Like, they could have bought Netflix, could have bought YouTube, right? Like, they could have been ahead of streaming really easily if they were obsessed with, you know, the problem instead of their service, right? Like, oh, we're a retail video rental company, right?
Well, usually the kind of the company that leads the status quo industry isn't the innovator in the next rendition of it. I mean, how many horse
hypocrisy takes over?
How many horse and buggy companies started car companies?
Yeah,
right.
So, if a business wanted to get involved with you, you're looking for enterprises, right, to get involved with, to work with your you at the GSU, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, Atlanta is.
How could a company come and, you know, have a conversation with you to see if there's ways that they can help you in helping the students?
Yeah. So if you Google Georgia State Social Entrepreneurship, that pulls up my contact information, cmarkle, C-M-A-R-K-L at gsu.edu. I'm really easy to find online. I mean, this is an amazing community, everything from one of the top technology hubs to this business radio show to major corporations being here. I mean, Atlanta is one of the reasons I accepted this position, because it's just an exciting, strong community of such smart business individuals that I think the more we can build bridges between Georgia State, the Robinson College of Business, and the Andrew Young School and these organizations, let's talk and innovate a way to work together.
What do you need more of?
I see the biggest opportunity around corporate social innovation. I think building relationships between Georgia State and those types of organizations would make a lot of sense. But I'm an innovative guy. Like, if anyone's interested, let's just talk.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Happy to be here.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton and our producer, Ryan Redhawk McPherson. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.